Welcome to the Now You Know Akron podcast, brought to you by the journalists of BeaconJournal.com. Each week, they will share their expertise on Akron and Summit County. Now, here's your host, Craig Webb.
Thanks for joining us for the Now You Know Akron podcast. I'm your host, Craig Webb. Our spotlight topic for today is gun violence in the city of Akron. We'll be joined by Akron Police Lieutenant Michael Miller, Akron City Councilman Russ Neal, and Tim Anderson, who is the founder of the Fallen Fathers Foundation. I must warn you, this is a frank discussion about the rise in violent crime involving guns in the city, so parental guidance is suggested. But first, here's three recent headlines from BeaconJournal.com. Our medical reporter Betty Lynn Fisher reports that Summit County's largest employer, Summa Health System, is raising its minimum wage for employees to $15 an hour. It's not the first employer in the region to raise the minimum wage to $15 and is nearly one of the last health systems in the area. As the largest employer in the county, it employs about 8,000 people. After weeks of silence, some new light is being shed on the accident at Cedar Point involving its Top Thrill Dragster roller coaster. The State Department of Agriculture held a press conference where it disclosed it was actually a piece of the car. The rear of the car is an L bracket that fell off of the ride and struck a woman who his family says is clinging for life. With its season about ready to begin, the University of Akron's football program has been sanctioned by the NCAA. The agency hit the University of Akron football program with sanctions for providing a forbidden loan to student athletes from a now former assistant director of athletics. The NCAA found that the UA violated bylaws related to the impermissible benefits to nine players by providing cash loans ranging from $100 to $1,000 each from a personal bank account. This is a violation and is considered a level one violation as a severe breach of conduct by the agency. For more on these stories and other headlines, BeaconJournal.com and our apps always feature updated headlines and subscriber-exclusive content that you can't find anywhere else. This past summer, and perhaps this spring too for that matter, has brought a wave of gun violence in major cities across the country, and Akron is no exception. Just recently, five people, including a 16-year-old girl, were shot in the heart of downtown Akron after an argument at a bar escalated and spilled out into the street. Thankfully, none of those injuries were life-threatening. But to put this all into perspective, and I need to note that as we record this podcast, there have been 35 homicides in Akron so far this year. There were 38 for all of 2019. Joining us for a roundtable discussion about gun violence in the city is Lieutenant Michael Miller, who's the head of Akron's Community Relations Department for the police department. He's also the department's public information officer, born and raised in Akron. We're also joined by Russ Neal, who is a councilman serving Akron's Ward 4, which encompasses parts of West Akron. He's been outspoken about the need to address gun violence, but also looking at the underlying issues that might contribute to it. And Tim Anderson, who is the founder of the Fallen Fathers Foundation. The nonprofit's mission is to help underprivileged families in Summit County, with a strong focus on at-risk youth. And to help move along this discussion and keep me on track is Sean McDonald, who is our breaking news reporter and covers public safety in Summit County, and hopefully he will chime in from time to time. So thank you all for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, I guess I'll start out, and I know it seems like a crutch to do this, and for those listening, I've been a reporter for some 30 years, and so I'm not saying that to brag, I'm just putting some context there, and I've been 20-plus years in Akron, and 10 years on Cleveland's eastern suburbs as a reporter, and I have to say that, you know, even when I was a young pup just out of college, we were talking about crime and safety, and maybe it's one of those basic needs is personal safety and public safety, but I guess I'd like to start with you, Lieutenant Miller. You know, are things different now? I mean, you know, I maybe you put perspective how long you've been on the force. I mean, are things worse? And what type of calls are your officers experiencing?
Well, certainly that's a great question. Thanks for having me again. I've been on for 22 years, approaching my 23rd year. And I think the consensus for folks here at the police department you know, around my tenure and or have been on slightly longer, is that we've not seen a time quite like this with respect to the number of gun-related incidents, the number of shots fired incidents, and the ages of the folks involved. So, I mean, it would be almost unheard of 10, 15 years ago to have, there certainly weren't as many daytime shootings, for example. That's one of the big changes that stands out. And almost every day or every other day, we get calls for service for shots fired. So there has been a shift, and that's one of the significant changes that I've seen at this point during my career.
Now, I remember one point there, the city of Akron had gotten some money to really target gun violence, and it was really almost a, you know, stop a car, we search a car, recover guns. I mean, we tried that. I mean, that wasn't necessarily the end-all solution. What can we do differently? I mean, is there some different approaches that now?
Well, I think the broader thing, and I think this is something that Mr. Neal would ultimately agree with as well. I think the response or the answer to that question is going to have to include people beyond the police department. What I mean by that is community folks, family members, clergy, people that either are connected to, have loved ones in that targeted age range, the most vulnerable folks who would likely be a part of something like this. It's time for communities to close that circle and increase the frequency in which they/we have conversations with our young people, because we're seeing 13 years old. We're seeing a case just recently, a few months ago, a 12-year-old playing with a gun inside a car, and on. And, you know, unless we all wrap our arms around the community in that fashion, I think we're going to lose the opportunity to, curb some of this. I mean, the police, just by the creation design of law enforcement is reactionary. So even our best efforts could fall short and don't speak to, you know, solutions that really will limit some of this, at a pace that it needs to, you know, especially when you compare the spikes. To your prior point, I'll mention, you know, we have some ongoing initiatives that we have that we're trying to use to target gun violence, relationships or partnerships with local and federal law enforcement agencies. So we have a lot of that going on daily, you know, investigative tools and aspects, not just, you know, yesterday, stop a car, stop a car, stop a car. That may not be the most useful way. So we use a data-driven approach. So where are some of these incidents likely to occur? Who are some of the known offenders? And try to identify these folks, have conversations with them kind of on the front end in hopes to deter some of that. So those are some of the approaches. But I think the solution has to at least include the community wrapping around this problem in a combined way if we're going to see any real significant reduction in it.
Russ, I think this is a good segue for you. I'm curious, I mean, what are your constituents and what are you hearing from residents? I mean, they, you know, we kind of have a difficult balance going here of people want to be safe, but there is some distrust of the police, right? A little bit. I mean, you know, as we talk about Black Lives Matter in that arena, I'm just curious, what are you hearing from your constituents?
Well, a little bit of everything. In relation to the gun violence that's happening in our community, though, the circles that I'm in understands that the community holds a large responsibility in addressing the issues. It's one thing when you talk about police violence. It's another thing when you talk about these shootings that are taking place, which is, you know, our children shooting each other. And Lieutenant hit it on the head. It's we have to approach this holistically. Gun violence is just an effect. We've got to get to the cause. And we've got to address just the this dominant culture that we've allowed to take hold amongst our community. And when I say dominant culture, I mean the mindset. To think that it's okay to pick up a gun to solve an issue. That didn't just happen. But there's a lot of things that have poured into that. I mean, you look at what we call entertainment now. You look at what we allow our children to play with that we call entertainment. You look at the music they listen to. You look at the programs that they watch. And then you throw on top of that all the social and economic factors, and you get what we have. So to address this issue, we have to address it holistically. But for the community to be able to address it, government has to, you know, we had this reimagined policing. If we're just dealing with policing, we're not dealing with the real issues. Because as Lieutenant Miller said, that's a reactionary response. We have to get to these things, to the things that create the culture that leads to the gun violence. So, I mean, city government has to be working very closely with our school system, with our grassroots community, our philanthropic community, and then all those institutions that provide supports for family, our county, juvenile court system, children's services. So, I mean, I could go on and on, but bottom line is we have to have a more holistic approach. We have to empower our residents with the tools and the resources to be able to provide that holistic approach.
Tim, I guess you're kind of working with youth, right? I mean, what are you hearing? I mean, why so young? I mean, why, you know, what has pivoted here to make this violence, I mean, involving teenagers? I mean, really, I mean, hard to even call them teenagers, right? I mean, 12-year-olds, 11-year-olds. I mean, I guess I looked at my 11-year-old self and I think, I don't know. I'm not sure I was a teenager at 11 or 12, but, you know, what are your thoughts?
I mean, when you really look at it from a broader view, the younger generation are more easily they're more impressionable. The streets are catching these guys at a young age, right? And just kind of like to piggyback off of what Russell said, it's the programming, the TV, the entertainment, even the video games. Like the video games, they're playing these Grand Theft Autos and Call of Duty. Everything is glorifying shooting. It's glorifying violence. You got 6 and 7 year olds that are playing these games and they are starting to feel like this is their norm. This is the thing to do, is glorified. So if they're picking this up at that age, by the time they get 10, 11, 12, and you got an older, you know, your older cousins, your older brothers, your family members are already off the porch, so to speak, and in the streets, they are putting these guns in their hand, putting these messages in their head, and it's easy for them to follow that. And they're under the impression that nothing's really going to happen to them. If I'm 12 or 13 and I go to juvenile court, I go to Dan Street, I'll be home in no time. And that's the way the 21s, the 24-year-old guys, this is what they're putting in these kids' heads. You know, grassroots organizations like mine, you know, we are able to, so to speak, integrate into these generations. So, like, I got a 17-year-old son and I have full custody of. And I've sat and listened to him and his friends or overheard conversations with them. And the stuff that they're into that they think is their norm, I mean, I can't even say, but it's bullshit. There's a bunch of bullshit going on. And it's okay to them. They don't fear death, for one. They don't fear death at all. Talking to some of my juvenile court kids, when you ask them what their 5-year plan is, most of them don't foresee themselves being here in the next 5 years, whether it's death or incarceration. They don't have a plan. They don't have a plan at all. And, you know, Lieutenant Miller he's right. Like, it's by the time it gets to the police department, it's too late by then. It's too late by then. By then, the problem's already been created. So, like, getting them while they're young and impressionable is the thing. Like, that's why I'm trying to start with my programs. 5, 6 years old. Let's catch them early. Let's catch them in the elementary stages, and let's mold them up. Let's teach them that they can be something different, that they can do other things. Because if we wait till they're 11, 12 years old, they're already influenced by someone. If you wait till they're 14, 15, 16, you're too late. You're too late, because you can't tell a 16-year-old nowadays anything. They know everything.
I have to say, Tim, you almost took my breath away when you know, we're talking about a 13-year-old who says the 5-year plan is, I don't think I'm going to be around in year 5. I mean, that's just, you know, it's the reality, but, you know, for, it is stunning. I mean, that's just a stunning. And so, Lieutenant Miller, I mean, how do you, what's your thought on that statement from a kid who's 13 says, I don't think I'm going to be around when I'm 18?
So I heard Mr. Anderson share that, and literally goosebumps. You know, that's an emotional, heavy thing to hear and be impacted by, and he's 100% correct. I've had many kids say something very similar. One of the programs that I'm involved in is through the juvenile court. They have a victim impact panel every month, the last Thursday of every month, and we talk to kids who have been court ordered. And many of them I've asked, like Mr. Anderson, you know, where do you see yourself, et cetera. And it's just painful to hear because the summary of all those responses is there doesn't appear to be any hope, you know. So, you know, from a police, you know, the shift is always, you know, as a policeman, you know, what do you think or this type of thing. And I think for all of us in our various professions and areas of expertise, it really is a question of humanity. So as a human being, as a spirit, what is our response to real community issues? And so what I've tried to do over my career, what I've tried to influence people that I have, you know, leadership role over is to show some humanity and display some humanity, and certainly behind the badge have some empathy, towards some of these problems, because not every child, not every kid, comes from circumstances like, most police officers. I happen to come from a dynamic, a demographic, much like the ones we're describing. Maybe that gives me an extra measure, of perspective. I don't know, but I think to Mr. Anderson's point, it is very heartbreaking to hear a child say, I don't know about that 5-year mark. And so, around to back to Mr. Neal's point, you know, a holistic attack it at the root, before it grows and allows to blossom into what it manifests itself in when we police officers are confronted with it. Without the attacking at the root, I don't know how effective we'll be.
How do you guys, and I guess whoever, you know, may want to answer it, I'll pose it to all of you. And something Tim shared with me at the beginning of this year is this idea of kids coming off the porch. When they come off the porch, who are they going to talk to? Who are their role models? How do we as a community start to give these kids role models and start to build hope for them?
I'll chime in. And first, I want to touch on something that Brother Anderson spoke of when he said these children aren't afraid to die. That's a cop-out that comes out in a lot of these music that they listen to. The real answer is they're afraid to live. It doesn't take any courage to die. Not the way these folks are. But it takes courage to live, to push through, to deal with all that's coming at you and not give up. And that's the message we got to get to our youth. It takes courage to live and challenge them to want to live. And that being said, It goes to us. I mean, I appreciate that. I could call this like a locker room experience conversation right here, because it's all men on this call. And bottom line, this is my truism. I just believe our communities reflect the presence or the lack of men, not males, but men. I mean, look at what Brother Anderson's organization is called, Fallen Fathers. Men who haven't taken up their responsibility or aren't able to take up the responsibility. We may not like having some of these conversations, but the bottom line is when men are present, things fall in order. I have a son who's about 28, and when he was young, one of the videos we had to watch every day was Lion King. There is a powerful message in that little Disney cartoon of a king, a man teaching his son of his responsibility to his community and to how he was to be a protector and not a predator. And of course, if all of us know Lion King, when his father died, little boy lost his way. And when that little boy lost his way, the community, because of a lack of the presence of a strong male, because you had his uncle Scar, who was a male, but he was weak. And he was a predator. He wasn't a protector. And it wasn't until he fell in place and took his rightful place within the cycle of life that things restored to order. Now, I know some people may not. For me, it's just that simple, but yet that complicated. So now, as a legislator, what is my responsibility? One is to understand that the way we govern right now has to change, and we have to empower the community with the tools and resources to be able to restore order in their local communities. And that's by forming, my belief is, one, forming collaboration between strong organizations that are made up of men, our fraternities, our Masonic order organizations, our those who coach, those who mentor, those who are in ministry. It's great to have your strong individual program, but that's just what it is. There's an African proverb that says when spider webs unite, they could tie up a lion. Individual spider web in and of itself can't do anything, but you get enough of them, they could tie up a lion. And that's the understanding that we have to have. We've got to do an assessment of what resources we have in our community, where there is common focus, and form collaboration between those first, and then between, since all of us are about serving the community, then form that greater portion of collaboration so that we could really address our community. I'm going to say this, then I'll stop. I appreciate you allowing me to talk this long. When we talk about collaboration in Akron, most people understand when you talk about it, when you talk about the I Promise School, when we talk about collaboration to provide wraparound support. LeBron took his life experiences and made sure that those children didn't have to experience what he experienced when he was growing up. He knew what it meant to go to school hungry, not to have clean clothes, to be without different resources. He knew what it meant to even have to move four or five times during the school year. And he took, because of his position, and made sure to put safety gaps in to address each one of those issues. Now, we don't have LeBron's money, but collectively, we have even more than what he has. And so that's why it's critical for us to understand as a community, we need to work together collectively and collaboratively to provide the wraparound support that our children need. And I like what Lieutenant Miller said. We've got to use the data that's before us. So we're not acting out of emotion or just responding, but real critical thinking. And I'll stop. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate the sentiment, but I would say as a son whose mother kind of kept me in line, my dad worked at a power plant, you know, I mean, I think it's, you know, that web can be both female or male to keep a wayward child in line too, you know, so, but
yeah. Oh, most definitely. I'm not going to argue against that, but I
it's leadership, right? I mean, it's kind of the parental, you know, and I kind of wonder, maybe, you know, you can speak to it too a little bit. You know, and we look back, I mean, historically, you think it's economic opportunity? You know, maybe a 13-year-old is thinking, maybe college isn't for me, but, you know, maybe there was a time when you were 13, you said, I'm going to go work at Goodyear. I'm going to go work at, you think it's that lack of economic future, maybe, if you don't go to college, that you know, could we better sell Akron that, maybe you could work at Amazon and make $16 an hour. You could buy a car. You could have an apartment. You could, you know, do we have to kind of show a economic future for the youth?
Craig, I believe we most definitely do. But you know what? I'm up here on North Hill, and I see our immigrant brothers and sisters come in here with basically nothing, and they'll set up shop. Economics is definitely a factor, but we should have the enough character within ourselves to understand just because I don't become a predator on others.
Right.
And I know some people may not like that, but I just look at the history of black folks. What have we ever been wealthy as a collective group of folks? But what we did have, we had the cultural dignity and integrity to love ourselves and our community enough to make a bricks without straw. I'll use that example. I just use that term. We built communities out of nothing. Now, what as a legislator, as government, what is our responsibility to do? Again, we got these American Rescue Plan dollars, is to make equitable investments in our community so that now don't have to make bricks out of straw. Or I'm sure Brother Anderson can attest to this. You drive down the street and you see the kids in the corner tagging because they don't have the money to provide for the program. We've got to be strategic and purposeful about investing in the right programs.
Not only that, this is a piggyback off of what Mr. Neal just said. So growing up in our, like in this generation now, what I'm noticing is they have a very strong sense of entitlement and they want instant gratification. So whereas I can watch the growth of a Russell Neal, I can watch Lieutenant Miller put forth all this effort to get to where they are today. But these kids can see that and they don't respect it. They respect the guy who got a bag and sold that dope and bought a foreign car or a belt or some Jordans in the 24 to 36 hours because they want it now. So we're creating programs, workforce development. You're offering jobs. It's like there's so many jobs available right now that people aren't even applying for because they want everything right now. They don't want to work for. So my biggest thing now is how do we instill that work ethic in them? And I mean, I can say I was guilty of it myself. I watched my dad was a supervisor for the city of Akron sewer maintenance department, worked my whole life. But I still seen him struggle, so I wanted my money now. And I had to learn the hard way. I had to go to the penitentiary. I had to be robbed at gunpoint. I had to be shot to wake up and realize, like, all right, maybe this isn't it. But a lot of these kids aren't getting that second chance. They're not getting that resurrection. Because nowadays, these guys got guns that are bigger than the ones they got in Afghanistan. You got 12 and 13-year-olds that know how to modify every gun possible. And they see it as power. So they, like you said, Russ, they'd rather take. They don't want to work for anything. And that's why I always say, like, you got to catch them while they're young and impressionable to instill that work ethic in them. Because these ones now, this generation now, I mean, you know, data says 16 through 24, but it's really 11, 12 years old when they're starting, when they're deciding that I ain't working for nobody. And a lot of that actually is being taught in the household. And I think that, I don't know if that's intentionally what the parents are trying to teach, but we're in a culture now where everybody has an entrepreneurial spirit. So everything is a hustle. Everything is about hustling. So they're teaching the kids to hustle. And the kids are taking that and turning it into something else. They believe that taking from somebody else is their hustle. So, like, our back's against the wall because it's like we're fighting an uphill battle and we don't have the support, whether it's a collaborative between us, we're still fighting the stigma that cash is king out here. And that's really what these kids want. They want cash by any means necessary. I seen a picture of a boy that I know for a fact is probably one of the most notorious shooters out here in these streets right now. And the boy can't be no older than 15, 16 years old. And he's got a stack of hundreds that he's probably collected from shooting somebody in the streets. But that's glorified because he up. In the words of these teenagers, he's up right now. He's up. Everybody's paying him to put in work. And it's like, how do you compete with that as a successful black man? Lieutenant Miller is a successful black man. Russ Neal is a successful black man. I am now a successful black man. doing it the legitimate way, but it's a 15-year-old right now who's got $30,000 worth of hundreds in a Facebook video because he went out and shot somebody for whoever, God knows who. We're competing with something that is like, is treacherous. It's kind of like the Space Jam movie. Like, we're going against the Monstars. We're going against the Goon Squad right now. Like, this uphill battle that we're fighting, this hill is steep. And it's not going to happen overnight for sure. Like, we've been talking about this probably since 2016 when I came home and we was trying to do Save Our Community events at Lawton and stuff like that. Like, we've been trying to figure this out, and it's only getting worse.
So I'm sitting here looking at a table. My glass is half full, and I refuse to drink out of it because I'm a half full kind of guy. Lieutenant Miller, maybe you can. I mean, is there hope today? I mean, is there a way to turn? Is there something the police department can do today, or has there been green shoots? Has there been success stories? Obviously, you grew up in Akron. You became a police officer in Akron. I mean, is there a young Lieutenant Miller somewhere in one of these neighborhoods who, you know, could be a police officer, or in the case of him, Anderson, of work for the city? I mean, you know, I'd like to end on a positive note here. Maybe we can, you know, maybe we can talk a little bit about what's happening today that has worked.
That's a great question. I think obviously I'm optimistic, a man of faith, and I think the answer is yes. There are greater Mike Millers. There are greater Russ Neals, Mr. Andersons, and Sean McDonalds, and Craigs. There are successful people beneath the soil, folks that are impacted by their environment, some not fault of their own because of circumstances, economic, as we mentioned, otherwise, puts people behind the eight ball. And when folks struggle in environments like that, or environments that I've grown up in, and each one of our experiences and perspectives are different, but they all are still very similar. So to the question, are there any Mike Millers out there? I think that answer is yes. We have to do the cultivation work. We have to be willing to, and I'm saying a slight shift from the police thing, because we're reactionary, we respond and things of this nature, but I'm saying to the extent that we can collaborate with one another from a program standpoint, we have to cultivate the soil and plant seeds of hope, even in folks that have made mistakes. And I often say that good people are making terrible decisions. The folks that have made terrible decisions that have had early interaction with the criminal justice system are no less worthy of hope and joy and love and prosperity as someone that grew up in a better circumstance. It's just given the opportunity to water the seed. There's potential in everybody. And if I didn't have anybody absent of my father, mentor, pour into me very early on, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you guys. So I embrace Mr. Anderson's message. Sean McDonald, he and I have talked at length. Mr. Craig, I know we share some things in common as well, Mr. Neal, but it is just that, we could talk about it, or we can decide to put some fuel in that tank and be about it and get there or get closer. There are some gifted, troubled individuals in this city. Troubled individuals that have a life full of potential and promise, whether it be art, music, writing, what have you. They get behind the eight ball, one grade behind, two grades behind, not in school, expelled. Then they're labeled, they're ostracized, and then, you know, they lose even more hope. And then once that snowballs, then of course, like Mr. Anderson said, well, look, I could either go work at Amazon or Lowe's, or I can do this in 10 minutes and make that. But we have to remind them that, like you said, in terms of that instant gratification, you could still hustle, but you got to reimagine what that process looks like. And shame on me if I'm a professional in any field and I look down my nose at someone, because just that way that I would interact with them, whether I'm a policeman or a council member, community advocate, or a journalist, sometimes in that small gap in that space could make a total difference in how someone eventually comes to see themselves. And just so with kids that I talk to, what have you, I remind them that they are somebody and that they are worthy and capable of all the things that they want. It just takes time, and we have to teach them the process, but they have it in them. And shame on anyone if we contribute to destroying that little thread that there, some of them are even holding on to.
Well, we could go on for hours, and I think we've gone on for an hour, perhaps. So I want to thank all of you for changing each corner of the world in Akron a little bit, and maybe we'll make a pledge that we'll get back together and see, you know, and hopefully we can, the numbers go down and we see change. So thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Appreciate you having us.
Thank you all.
That's all we have today for the Now You Know Akron podcast. Be sure to join us again next week. Episodes are released every Wednesday wherever you download your favorite podcast and are also available on beaconjournal.com and all our various apps. Before we go, we have to thank our producer, BJ Lisko. And we also urge you to support local journalism by becoming a subscriber. If you've already signed up, we thank you. Until next week, Now You Know Akron.